So with that said, again, if I seem to go rather quickly, or maybe not, do not make myself clear in certain occasions, or if you have additional questions, don't hesitate to come up afterwards and please fire away, and I'll try to answer whatever questions I can. But again, want to thank the elders for giving me this opportunity, and of course the presence of each and every one of you here this evening. On the last presentation, I received a lot of positive comments and feedback, and of course I really appreciate that, and a lot of you came up to me during the course of the last several weeks inquiring about when I was going to give the next presentation and how much you were looking forward to it. So again, all of your comments are a great value to me, and I certainly appreciate those things. So I was speaking to Travis earlier and mentioned to him that he had said, you know, with the vast amount of pictures that were shown in the last presentation, I think it had whetted some of your appetites to perhaps go and visit the nation of Israel. I'm thinking perhaps maybe after tonight, some of you might be booking your trips tomorrow. So again, if some of you want to go, if you have any travel questions, please ask my mother. She's the expert on that. So with that, let's make sure this thing's working okay. Do I need to turn it on first, probably? No? Yeah. There we go. Aha, there we go. Okay, so if you recall last time, this was the last slide that we had shown in our presentation. This was the mosaic floor that was left over from a 3rd century synagogue that would put us in middle Roman period, 3rd century AD synagogue, at the town of Hamat Taviera, which is just south of Tiberias on the western coast of the Sea of Galilee. And of course, we were all puzzled by what we saw on the floor. Of course, up here at the top, it might be a little difficult to see that. But of course, that's a mosaic of the temple. So to us, being in a synagogue, that shouldn't be of much surprise. However, though, as we made our way down to the middle of the mosaic here, we see the wheel of Zodiac and this picture of this person here in the center, who is Helios, the Greek god of the sun. And of course, we ask the question, what in the world is this picture, this representation of the zodiac wheel and the Helios, God of the Greek god of the sun, doing on this floor in a Jewish synagogue? Now, of course, when I asked Galad, who was our travel guide, he said that archaeologists weren't quite for sure, and the Israeli government really had no official position on it. But us, knowing our Bible history, knowing our history of the Old Testament, and understanding that the Jews always had a problem from the very beginning about lusting after other gods and wanting to serve other gods, to us, of course, it naturally came as no surprise. And if you recall, and if you weren't here previously, I apologize. Again, if you have questions, don't be hesitant to ask. But we had tied this in with the Temple of Pan. Remember when we were up in Panaeus? The Jews call it Panaeus. The actual place is called Banias, which is the Arabic term. But we were up there in Panaeus, which was renamed later Caesarea Philippi. Remember, we talked about the significance of that. And this Temple of Pan that was up in the Caesarea Philippi or Panaeus area during the time of Jesus. So we talked about those things and the significance of those things. So during the rest of our evening, what we are trying to do this evening is we are going to be back up in the Caesarea Philippi area. And we are going to work our way south right here to the base of the Sea of Galilee, and of course continuing down here to the Jerusalem area, including Emmaus over here, Tel Azekah as well, Jerusalem, over to the Qumran Caves and down to Masada. So we're going to try to get through all that this evening. I know it sounds like a lot, but we're going to move rather quickly. So what we're doing is making our way back up to Caesarea Philippi here to the palace of Agrippa, specifically Agrippa II. Now, if you recall previously, we talked about that after Herod's death, his son Philip the Tetrarch moves the administration up to Panaeus, okay, the Temple of Pan area there, and renames the city Caesarea Philippi in honor of Augustus and, of course, in honor of himself, and also to distinguish it from Caesarea Maritime, which we discussed in the previous presentation. So here we get up to the palace of Agrippa II. Now, his father was Agrippa I, who we know put James to death, imprisoned Peter. We know, according to Acts chapter 12, an angel struck him and he died. He was eaten alive by worms. Okay, that's the Agrippa I. This is his son's palace, Agrippa II, the same Agrippa II whom Paul presented a defense before in Acts chapters 25 and 26, okay? And we're familiar with those chapters. Governor of that area, Festus, is having difficulties dealing with Paul because he can't really find any reason why he is guilty of the charges that the Jews have brought before him. And he's trying to figure out, okay, well, Paul has appealed to Caesar. I have to write to Caesar to tell him what charges that, you know, he's accused of, and I can't even do that. Agrippa just happens to come in town, King Agrippa II, and Paul presents his same defense to King Agrippa II. The same Agrippa II whom Paul asks the question, "Dost thou believe the prophets? I know thou believest." And of course, we all know King Agrippa's answer, "Almost hast thou persuaded me to be a Christian." This is his palace, the entrance of his palace, over 21,000 square feet. It is one of the largest and most magnificent buildings that has ever been constructed in the nation of Israel. 21,000 square feet. What is interesting about the construction of it, but yet typical for large palaces, is there's mainly one small entrance at the front. And once you enter into the palace, it's made up of several narrow corridors that zig and zag. And it's at the very back of the palace where you get to the larger rooms, which would have been the residences of the king and, of course, his family. And, of course, that's done for defense purposes. Invading forces come in, intruders come in. They want to be able to bottleneck them up in these long hallways that move to the left or the right so they can destroy those intruders and prevent them from getting back towards the back area of the private residences, which you see more here in the back area. But again, you're able to make out a lot of the maze of the tunnels and the archways and walkways and hallways that are there in the palace as we move forward. And again, going down the ladders to the columns and different walkways that you see there, again, it represents what we talked about, really a maze or a labyrinth of hallways that you work your way through, all done for defense purposes. And of course, there's one that really illustrates. That's, I think, my sister going down the steps there. But again, going down the steps and seeing up closer of these hallways that would zig and zag, and again, to bottleneck intruders who were trying to ransack the palace. So, very interesting there as we looked at the palace of Agrippa II, and of course, understanding his role and of course, his relationship with Paul for those few chapters that we see in Acts chapter 25 and 26, but again, over 21,000 square feet, a massive building. So, as we look at that, we go ahead and we exit Agrippa's palace, which is in Caesarea Philippi, and we go right down the road to Dan, to Tel Dan, okay? You could literally walk there. It's in just about the same location. It's that close. If you have time, laterwards, or now if you want, look in your Bibles, and you could tell when you look at a New Testament map versus an Old Testament map, Dan and Caesarea Philippi are right next to each other. But we're Americans. We didn't walk. We rode the van. It was all set done. It was a little warm that day. But anyways, we're going to ancient Dan. Here is a picture of what they called the Israel Gate. Now, we know according to Judges chapter 18 that originally this town was not called Dan. It was called the town of Laish. Remember? In Judges chapter 18, Dan's original inheritance or allotment, that territory was over west of Jerusalem along the Mediterranean coast where the Philistines were. But just like a lot of the other tribes, in Judges chapter 18, they have difficulty dealing with the Philistines. So what do? They basically give up and they say, hey, we got to find another location that's easier for us to take over. So let's send out some spies and try to find a different location. What do? They travel way up north to the town of Laish, a peaceful people. And what they decide to do is to ransack, burn the town, kill the people, and take over. And that's exactly what they do in Judges chapter 18. And what they end up doing is naming the town Dan after their forefathers. So we come here to the Israel Gate. This gate, according to archaeologists, dates sometime between 1100 or about 1150 to about 1050 BC, which puts us right in about that time period of the Judges. So this is the Israel Gate, a closer picture of it. Probably an American on her cell phone there, I'm thinking. So, but anyways, cell phones are everywhere. She's probably going to take a selfie after that. So, but anyways, we come to the Israel Gate. Now, what's interesting is that what we're trying to do is we're at the base of Tel Dan, okay? And we're trying to work our way up to the high place, the place of worship. So Dan was one of the most surprising things to us, because when we got there, we weren't expecting this. We weren't expecting the topography. We weren't expecting the climate. As we made our way up to Dan, notice how lush and green it is. This is how Caesarea Philippi looks. If I was to ask you beforehand, hey, what do you think Dan looks like? What do you think Caesarea Philippi looks like? I think a lot of you would probably say, oh, probably some kind of barren wilderness. I mean, when we think of a lot of Israel, that's naturally what we associate with, and a lot of that is correct. But up here, you're moving from the Sea of Galilee, which is about 500 or 600 feet below sea level, up to Dan, which is at the base of Mount Hermon. Okay, and so you move up several thousand feet in elevation, and as you do, the climate and the ecosystems changes along with the topography. It's lush. It's green. It's absolutely beautiful. There's the Dan Spring, one of the tributaries to the Jordan River. So we're working our way up to the top of the city of Dan to tell Dan to the high place of worship, but absolutely gorgeous scenery. We weren't expecting that. In fact, if I was to liken it to anything, when we were taking the walk up to the top of Tel Dan, we were also pleasantly surprised. I kept telling myself, this reminds me, in fact, Jimmy, I'll point out to Jimmy because he'll know what I'm talking about. Grandpa Al's cabin. Walking from the cabin to the watering holes, to the swimming holes. That's kind of what you're looking at. That's what we all kind of in our group echoed those same sentiments as, wow, it's like being up at the cabin. And maybe some of you have been up to Grandpa Al's cabin. Maybe it's been a few years. But you walk back to those watering holes, and it's lush. It's green. We were not expecting it. What a pleasant surprise. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to get to the high place on Tel Dan. Now, here's what's interesting. You look up here, and you see these stones, and you see the workmanship, the hewning of the stones. Those actually date back to Canaanite time, okay? To pre-Canaanite or to Canaanite time period, old Canaanite time period, which predates Israel's entrance into the land by some 500 or 600 years, okay? So the importance of this, and notice this metal frame, we'll talk about this in 1 second, but the importance of this is to show that it was a typical process when invading armies came in to ransack a city, to burn it down and to take over. Whatever was left over, as far as building materials, infrastructure, stones, you name it, what did they do with those? They repurposed them. They used them again in order to reconstruct buildings and places of importance. And according to Judges 18, after they ransacked the town, they rebuilt the high places. So they took Canaanite stones, Canaanite workmanship, and they reworked it and repurposed this area again to sacrifice idols and, of course, sacrifice idols and to continue with their ritual worship. Now, we get up to the top, and you can see a better view of this high place here. Now, this is what's interesting. When you get here into this metal box or frame that is protected here, what's interesting is that archaeologists started excavating in this little section right here. Do you know what they found there? They found ritual artifacts dating back to the first temple period, which puts us at 930 BC. Now, I know y'all know your Bibles pretty well and you know your history. 1 Kings chapter 12 talks to us and tells us, gives us the story about the splitting of the kingdom. Remember, Rehoboam does not listen to the advisors of his father Solomon, but instead listens to the young advisors. The northern tribes come to him, and they ask him, what? Go easier on us. Your father oppressed us. He gave us a heavy hand, a heavy burden. We'd like you to lighten it up. We'd like you to lighten it up. And, of course, you remember Rehoboam's response. What? My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. And so, in essence, he was telling them, you thought you had it bad with my father Solomon. I'm really going to lay it on you. And so Israel basically looks at Rehoboam and says, what part of Jesse or what part of David, the father, the son of Jesse, do we have? And so in turn, we know that what? They succeed. They leave Judah, and who do they anoint as king over them? But Jeroboam. Now we know, according to 1 Kings chapter 12 again, in the story, that Jeroboam is concerned that the people in the northern tribes will switch allegiances back to whom? Back to Judah, when they have to go back down to the temple to sacrifice. So, how does he take care of this potential problem? He sets up what? A golden calf in Bethel, and he sets one up where? In Dan. 930 BC, this is the high place. This is it. Now, interesting. See these steps behind it and how it leads out to this platform area? That's your view from the platform. Now, our tour guide, Galad, brought up a very interesting point. He said, you know, if I was king of Israel, I would take that golden calf and I would place it right out on this perch where the platform is. Because out here on this platform, when you're overlooking this area, this is the Jordan River Valley, the upper Jordan River Valley. If you're traveling from the north and you want to reach the interior of Israel, this is your main artery. This is your main highway. We're looking to the west and we're looking to the north, okay? Everywhere in this valley, as you look towards this way, towards the east, you see this high place. It's visible from everywhere. And if you were to put a golden calf anywhere, I bet you they might put it right there. Why? Well, I mean, you heard that term, out of sight, out of mind? Well, I'll submit to you the opposite tonight. If you can see that golden calf, and you can definitely see the high place, that acts as a reminder to everybody living and working in this area or traveling through this area where their allegiances belong. This place was incredible to attend. And going back to this high place, and again, up those steps to that perch area, this is where, in this, somewhere in this immediate vicinity, was where the golden calf was placed. This is Tel Dan. All right. Leaving Dan in Caesarea Philippi, we're going to work our way down to the lower Jordan River Valley, just below the Sea of Galilee, to the location called Yardanit. This is the traditional site of Jesus' baptism. Or is it? I don't know. You ask them, they're pretty adamant about it. Then you go down the river a few miles, and then there's another place, and they're pretty adamant about it. And then you go down a few more miles, and there's another place, and they're pretty adamant about it. Remember in our last presentation, the picture I showed of Simon the Tanner? The door in Joppa? Remember, that's where Peter stayed. It was upon that rooftop he had his vision. Our trip, remember, our trip was not necessarily to see the typical Christian sites. We wanted to go to places that did have historical merit, okay? This place is visited by 500,000 Christians every year. They have a store there. It's the size of Walmart. I'm not kidding. It's not literally a Walmart, but it's a Walmart. You know what you do there? You go down there and you buy your white robes so you can get baptized in the Jordan, along with jewelry, holy water, necklaces, wine, you name it, they sell it. And when it's all said and done, it's just people trying to make a buck who prey upon, you know, the religious, ignorant people who exist out there. I'm sorry I have to say it, but it's just true. This is a Christian tourist trap. And so we ask, okay, well, why do they think this is one of the locations where, or the location that Jesus was baptized? There's no historical merit to it whatsoever. The only thing I can surmise is, it's beautiful there. It's one of the most picturesque places on the Jordan River. There's a lot of spots of the Jordan River that, you know, are not easy on the eye. You know, there is some vast wilderness areas that it goes through. But you look here and it's gorgeous there. Hey, if I was going to be baptized anywhere, I think it'd be here. I think Naaman was looking in the wrong location. If he would have looked here, he probably would have, you know, would have decided sooner. But we see here that it's gorgeous, it's picturesque, but again, there's no historical merit, okay? Here, that's Galad, our actually tour guide right there, along with myself, my mother, and Lorna. And you might be able to make out back here in the group, see that there? There's a group of people that are there, they're conducting a worship service, and they're all wearing white shirts, but they were all had white robes with them, and you know that when they were done, they were going to get their white robes on and walk down and be baptized into the Jordan River. So to us, no, is it the location of Jesus' baptismal site? We don't know. But what is important is Jesus was baptized in the Jordan, correct, by John. There was a reason, a purpose for it. And we got to see the Jordan River. And we think about the importance and significance of the Jordan River. the children of Israel crossing the Jordan River in Joshua chapter 3 and 4. We talk about the story of Naaman and so forth. Jordan was important for us to see, but as far as it being the actual site, we don't know. But that's not important. And we tried to explain that to our tour guide as thoroughly as we could. So, anyways, we leave the Jordan, lower Jordan Valley area, and we're making our way to Jerusalem right down here. But before we hit Jerusalem, we got to make a quick stop, very quick, in the town of Emmaus. That is, of course, a map that shows how the city was during about the 6th century or so. Now, here are the ruins of the remains of a Byzantine basilica, probably constructed sometime between the 5th and 6th century. And so the question might ask, okay, well, why would they build a basilica there? Well, by the 5th century, Emmaus had become a popular pilgrimage journey for Christians. Why? Well, you should know that, right? In Luke chapter 24, after Jesus' resurrection, whom does he make his first appearance to? Two disciples on the road to Emmaus, and we know eventually as he is discussing with them the scriptures and talking about the importance of the Messiah and the fulfillment of prophecies, they urge him to stay with him in Emmaus for the night. He breaks bread with them, and we know after blessing the bread and breaking bread that what? It's, you know, their eyes are open and they see that it is Jesus in his resurrected form, and then of course he vanishes from their sight. So Emmaus was important to Christians as far as a pilgrimage goes, at least 5th and 6th century Christians, in regards to the significance that Emmaus was, again, being the first place where our Lord and Savior revealed himself after his resurrection. Emmaus is also important, just as a side note, that Judas Maccabee here had a very successful campaign against the Greek authority, the Ptolemies, and achieved a very significant battle or victory here in battle just outside of Emmaus, which helped usher in the Hasmonean period. So again, Emmaus is important for a lot of reasons. So we move forward. Oh, anybody know what that is? You remember what it is. It's a baptismal is what it is. Built for a few, it looks like. We'll maybe talk about that later if we have time. All right, so we work our way from Emmaus back into... There it is. I mean, this is really the reason why we wanted to go to Israel. We wanted to see Jerusalem. We wanted to see a lot of things. I wanted to see Jerusalem. Okay? This picture is taken from the southwest. Hey, there's the Kidron Valley right there. Didn't you always imagine it that it would be bigger? That doesn't look like much of a valley, does it? But their definition of a valley, from our definition of a valley, is a lot different. The valleys are much smaller there. But there's the Kidron Valley, which means there's the Hinnom Valley right there. You see the wall of the old city, Dome of the Rock Mosque, right there, hard to make out. We might get a closer picture of it, the Al-Aqsa Mosque as well. But in turn, the Hinnom Valley, the Kidron Valley, this right here, and we'll see a better picture of it, right here, 60 degrees upslope, right there. You know how much 60 degrees is? Hinnom Valley side, 40 degrees. This is what makes Jerusalem such a popular place. It's because of its defense system that's in place. But again, closer picture up. And again, what we'll see here in just a little bit is you'll work your way over into here, which is the actual original old city of David. We'll get to that here in just a few minutes, right in this area here. In fact, we'll talk about here in a few minutes, Western Wall. Some of you say, oh, Wailing Wall. Jews don't call it the Wailing Wall. Christians have adopted that term. Jews call it the Western Wall. This is the upper course. We're kind of talking about this for just a couple minutes. What's hidden here is below the street level, there are 17 courses of stone that date back to the Second Temple, Herod. Okay? And those stones lie beneath the street, 17 courses. We did go down there and look at them. Unfortunately, all the pictures were so dark, they're really not viewable. But what you see here is that this wall that was built on top of the remaining of the Western Wall, again, which is below the street level, which represents in chronological order your different time periods that were influenced by Jerusalem. Stonework here during the Byzantine era. Work your way up, stone here done through the Crusader era, and working your way up to the top, stonework done through the Ottoman empire. You'll notice that as you work your way up from bottom to top, the stonework gets cruder and cruder. Now you might ask, why is that? When Herod built the temple, he spared no cost. I mean, they put all kinds of money, and we'll see some pictures of those stones. But as you get up here, you know, time is of the essence, and so many times the walls are destroyed and rebuilt taller in haste for defense purposes. They didn't have time and necessarily the money to try to copy what Herod had done. They're just trying to get the walls back up for defense purposes, okay? And we'll notice that here in a few more pictures. But the Western Wall, and as we move forward, that was not a very good photo. We tried to use some color enhancement. But there you do see the Dome of the Rock Mosque, and over here the Al-Aqsa Mosque as well. But as we move forward and work our way down to the area, there you see men getting ready, putting on their traditional religious garb in order to write down prayers on a piece of paper, roll them up, and place them inside the wall, which I think some of you in the audience have been to this location. Notice as I back up, men to the left, women to the right. Okay? You do not intermingle the sexes. Men to the left, women to the right. And of course, you know what those are, right? Getting their phylacteries ready, placing them on, and again, getting them ready for the service that they'll conduct there at the wall. Notice myself and Brian in the background trying to look interested in what Gilad is telling us, which we were, but I think at that particular time, he was pointing out to us the little scrolls that were placed inside of the wall, prayers and requests by people. So we go through, and again, these are just some different pictures to once again demonstrate to you the wall work that you'll see there as you work your way up from Byzantine to Crusader up into the very top areas that were done during the Ottoman Empire. Again, as you can see, as you work your way up, this is again on the south side of the city, taken below where the near the city of David. But again, you can see the wall work there. Here's a better picture. Notice the detail on these stones here and that edging hewn from the stone. Those are rocks. That's how you can tell those were done during Herod's time, Second Temple. Okay? Very large stones, very clean lines, very detailed. Again, being in the stone industry, I am very impressed at the work and the amount of manpower and hours that it took in order to construct the temple and also parts of the outer wall. Just very, very impressive. This is to give you an idea of the scale. That is my wife and I. We have climbed up steps to the base of it, and again, you see the different rocks reflecting the different periods from Byzantine and Crusader up to Ottoman Empire. Okay? Absolutely massive, absolutely fascinating. Okay? Here's a picture at night on the western side of the city near the Jaffa Gate. This was the first night we stayed the night in town. Our hotel was a mile and a half away from the old city. So most of the nights, even when we were done, we would walk down to the city. It's you know, for a place that has a lot of hostility, it's absolutely beautiful and gorgeous, especially at night when they light it up. But again, just a different vantage point from the western side of the city. So let's work our way into the heart underneath the city, the old city. And we come to the entrance, and you can't see it there on the sign, but this is the entrance to the Hezekiah Tunnel. All right? We know about the significance of the importance of the Hezekiah Tunnel. 2 Kings chapter 20, 2 Chronicles chapter 32 talks about this waterwork system that Hezekiah put in place. What he was doing, there's only one natural source of spring water or natural source of water in Jerusalem. That's the Gihon Spring. What Hezekiah was doing was taking that water from the Gihon Spring and diverting it to the west side of the city in order to protect that resources from the threat of the Assyrian army. Okay? Very important. And so what they did was they dug this tunnel 1,875 feet long. Most scholars and experts agree that this is the greatest water, technological water engineering feat done in the pre-classical period. Remember when I showed you slides of Megiddo last time? And remember the water system we looked at Megiddo and it was attributed to Ahab? Remember that? This one's 8 times longer. That's to kind of put it in perspective. You can work your way down to there. And in fact, actually, if you have the right gear on, you know, probably some swim trunks or something, you can actually go down the tunnel itself. The problem is for people like me is in a lot of areas it's only 2 feet wide. I don't think I can get through that. But you can do that 11 feet to 4 feet in height. So there's times where you're on your hands and knees. There's times where it's really tight, but you can work your way down it. They said it's kind of yucky. They said it's kind of messy. I would liken it probably to like spelunking. So if you like the spelunking, go cave exploring. This is Travis. This will be right up your alley when you go to Jerusalem. Okay. Ah, interesting. So then we work our way around the rest of the old city and we come down. It's protected overhead out of the elements. They built this whole structure around these very large residences. Opulent, large, beautiful. Notice the detailing on the flooring. It's not even mosaic. That's some kind of crazy pattern I've never even seen before. And I would hate to try to duplicate because it would just, the time involved with that would be amazing. So Galad said, asked us, he said, does anybody care to guess, I mean, whose houses do these belong to? And so we're thinking, like wealthy businessmen, people of great affluence. Who are they? These are the priest's house. The priests. I mean, this is big bucks. And so Galad, who is not a religious man, okay, he's Jew, but he's not a religious man, his take was, look, Jesus was a threat to the economical condition that the priesthood had set up. With people having to pay for the sacrifices, for the temple taxes, for all those things that they put in place, the priest class had become wealthy, all on the backs of their fellow countrymen. And so they looked at Jesus as a threat to their economic means because they lived in opulence. Not all of them, but many of them did. And these are so close to the temple, they could literally walk right out of their house, not even have to confront public or any of the masses, and walk right into the temple area in these huge houses. He called them the Bill Gates of ancient Jerusalem, is what he called them. That's how wealthy they were. So we went down, and just amazing to see these ruins. Oh, we come to the Pool of Siloam. Okay, this is absolutely fascinating. Okay? We come to the Pool of Siloam. That's a little back picture there of just a little collection of water. But the real picture I want to get to is this. Okay? That's me right there. The Pool of Siloam, again, it's not the greatest picture, but in here, this is the actual Pool of Siloam. Okay? Now, we know the significance of the Pool of Siloam because in John chapter 9, remember, Jesus is going to heal a blind man. So what does he do? He takes earth and spit, mingles it together, puts the mud on his eyes, and tells him what? Go wash in the Pool of Siloam. And that's what the man does. And of course, John chapter 9 is dedicated to that entire story in the aftermath. Remember after that? Because what takes place? Jesus heals him. It's on the Sabbath. Remember? And then the Pharisees get involved. And it's quite the story. All of John chapter 9 is dedicated to that. But here's what's interesting about this. So here's the Pool of Siloam. Now, we're there at the end of October. The wet season begins about mid-November. And so once you get into the wintertime, this pool naturally fills up. In fact, what's interesting is the Hezekiah Tunnel, where they divert the water from the Gihon Springs, ends up in the Pool of Siloam. Now, here's what's fascinating. See this cleft of this rock sticking out right here? Up above it is the Pool of Siloam. Now, does that make sense? This is the Pool of Siloam, but up here is the Pool of Siloam. That doesn't make any sense. Back in the 4th and 5th century, Byzantine Christians were digging around Jerusalem, and they found a pool up here, and based on old maps, they thought this was the Pool of Siloam. So what they did was they basically remodeled it. And so if you were to go there today, it looks like a Byzantine pool area, because they thought it was the Pool of Siloam, and they basically remodeled it. So for literally centuries and centuries and centuries, they thought up here in this area, this was the Pool of Siloam. Until 2005. Some of you might remember this story. In 2005, workers for the city of Jerusalem are trying to extend the sewage system into this part of the city. They start digging up and they uncover steps. These steps that you see here. Oops. These steps that you see here. It just so happens by chance, archaeologists are working in the area at a different site, but they notice these steps and they tell them to stop working. So they go in there, they start examining it, and they start excavating the rest of it. And they come to find out, and looking at the workmanship and the stones and dating it, this dates exactly to the Second Temple era, the period of Herod, time period of Herod, and the time period of Christ. So after all these centuries and centuries, they go, oh, the Pool of Siloam isn't up here. This is the Pool of Siloam, right here. Unearthed and left in its natural findings as they dug it up. Very fascinating. Right when you think you got an answer, it changes. So then we come to the city of David, the original city of David, which is just below the outside walls of what we refer to as the old city of Jerusalem. But we come to the city of David, and why do I have a picture of that car there, that van? Notice all the dings and dents in it. Notice that? Notice this wiring and barbed wire or whatever material that is to protect the windows. This is a Israeli government vehicle. Okay? When you go into the city of David, and these are the ruins from the Jebusite city and later the city of David, Jerusalem. This area, this neighborhood, this is right in the middle of a neighborhood that's occupied by Arabs and Palestinians. Okay? This is a hotly contested area. Okay? It's so contested that that's the main reason why they've kind of slowed down any of the archaeological and excavation work. I mean, it's almost at a standstill. And they basically just converted this area into a park for people to witness and to view. So as far as work done there, there's next to nothing done anymore. If they could continue to work there, they would find a slew of things there. But again, every time they try to send a government vehicle in there, let's go back. They pound it with rocks, is what they do. The Palestinians don't want the Jews in there digging because it's their neighborhood. So we go through and we look at the ruins of the city of David, the town of the Jebusites. According to 2 Samuel chapter 5, David finally takes over the city of the Jebusites, naming it Jerusalem. Less than 11 acres. Less than 11 acres is how big that town is. Anywhere from, depending on what scholar you ask, 1,500 to 3,000 inhabitants. Okay? A very small city, but from these pictures here, these are taken from the city of David looking down on the Kidron Valley. Again, look at that. 60-degree slope. Try to climb that. I don't want to try to climb that. Looking down on the Palestinian neighborhoods, you can definitely tell the difference between Palestinian neighborhoods and Jewish neighborhoods. Okay? It really reflects the socio and economic disparity that exists in that country. If you want to know more about that, ask me afterwards. Ask my mom. Ask Brian. You can tell the difference between Palestinian neighborhoods and Jewish neighborhoods. For the most part, we'll get to that in a second. But again, looking from that, again, what made the city of the Jebusites so alluring to David? Because of its defense capabilities, okay? Not a big area. But anytime invading armies came in to ransack or to siege Jerusalem, they attacked on the north side because the slopes on the north side of the city are far gentler than what exists to the south, to the east, and to the west. Very sure. Okay, we are in the market areas. Quickly, we go through the market areas. Don't go with an appetite, because boy, you will eat things right and left. I mean, absolutely fascinating. But we get into the market area. This is on a Friday morning about 9 o'clock. And by the time we leave, and again, hard to tell with the pictures here, but by the time we leave by 10 or 11 o'clock, that market is full. Why? It's Friday morning. What happens at sundown? Shabbat, Passover happens. So people are out in the markets getting their preparations, getting their food ready so that they can make their Sabbath meal and be in before sundown when they blow the horn. And you know it's Sabbath. Ooh. Remember I said sometimes, you know, you can tell the difference between Jewish neighborhoods and Palestinian neighborhoods? Not really necessarily here. Okay. Some of you have been to Jerusalem, yes? Okay, I know some of you have. Did you go into the Orthodox neighborhoods? If you did, see me afterwards. We got a lot to talk about. Absolutely crazy. Okay? Read the signs. Groups passing through our neighborhoods severely offend the residents. Please stop this. Please do not pass through our neighborhoods in immodest clothes. Of course, they did say we beg you with all our hearts, so, you know, can't blame them. Closed blouse, long sleeves, long skirt, no tight-fitting clothes. Please do not distress, do by disturbing the sanctity of our neighborhood and our way of life as Jews submitted to God and His Torah. So those are the signs that you see when entering into these Orthodox neighborhoods. And I will tell you, if you ever go to Jerusalem, you go into an Orthodox neighborhood, it is being on a different planet. I kid you not. They are packed in like sardines. Here's some, you know, cute little boys in their Orthodox garb. And what you do is you go into these neighborhoods, you see all the traditional dresses here. There are thousands of people that occupy these small neighborhoods, like sardines, or as our guide, as our tour guide put, they're like rats that multiply like rabbits, is what he says. Now, it's interesting that he said that because it's a very odd paradox, okay? Because the Orthodox Jews do not support the Israeli government, okay? In fact, if you're in Israel, you know, there's mandatory military service, government service, but the Orthodoxes fight that, don't want any part of that. They don't like paying taxes. And what they say is that, look, when the Messiah comes, because they're still waiting for the Messiah will establish a government and restore all things. So we don't need this Israeli government. So in many ways, they are anti-Israeli government until the Messiah comes. But what's interesting is that they have families, and they have numerous amounts of children. In fact, when we were taking a tour inside the city of Jerusalem, our tour guide stopped us for a second, went in and spoke to a lady that he hadn't seen in a few weeks. And he came back out, and we said, oh, you know, do you know that lady? He goes, yeah, I've known her through the years doing these tour guides. And she just had another child, and she's, you know, she's been on maternity leave. I go, oh, okay, so, you know, how many kids she have? This is her 14th child, okay? The Orthodox families, they have families, and they have child upon child upon child. And then they say, well, we want to have large godly families. But you know what they get for every child that is born? They get a government stipend. But they don't support that government. Does that make any sense? What a paradox it is. And so Galad, and he says he represents how most Jews feel about the Orthodox, they don't like them. And they also don't like them because they don't take care of their neighborhoods. Do you see the filth and trash? Do you see that? Now, I was joking with Galad, and I said, you know, we have a saying in the United States, cleanliness is next to godliness. And I said, you know, this is such a poor reflection on their neighborhoods. How can they let that be? And he said, they will tell you, the men, they don't have jobs. They study the law is what they do. They get together and they study the law. Most of the women have jobs and also have to take care of all the kids, okay? But they sit there and they reflect on the law because to them, matters of the outside don't reflect a real Jew. He's on the inside reflecting on the law and studying the law. So just kind of frustrating. Again, entering the synagogue, men on the left, women on the right. Okay. Unfortunately, that's quick in Jerusalem, but let's get to Tel Azekah. Now, Azekah is important in the Old Testament. It's mentioned several times. Joshua chapter 10. Joshua is confronting the five kings of the Amorites. And what happens is on the road from Beth-horon to Azekah, the Lord puts the enemies of the Israelites into a state of confusion. And on the road from Beth-horon to Azekah, the Lord casts hailstone on the road, destroying many of those opposing forces. In fact, it says even more than the Israelites put to the sword. And lastly, the Lord makes the sun stand still so Joshua and his men can continue to fight. The road from Beth-horon to the city of Azekah right here runs right through this triangle-shaped valley, which is also known as the Valley of Elah. Now you might say, Valley of Elah, that takes us to 1 Samuel chapter 17. What great event took place? The Valley of Elah? You have the battle of David and Goliath happening right here in the Valley of Elah. Now, when you look behind Azekah to the west, now you're looking out towards the Mediterranean coast. This is the land of the Philistines. Okay? Pretty flat. What's interesting is if you look on a map and you look at Azekah, or Azekah, however you want to pronounce that, Gath is about 4 miles to the east of Azekah, and about 8 miles northwest of the Philistine town of Ekron, okay? Now, if you want, as I'm explaining it, go to 1 Samuel 17 if you want to do that. It's your purview to do so. But what's interesting is that, let's fast forward to this. Thank you, Google Maps. Here is an aerial view of the Valley of Elah. Here is Azekah right over here. We are standing on Azekah, and we are looking eastward towards this valley, kind of shaped like a triangle here. See that here? Now, we know according to 1 Samuel chapter 17 that the Philistines are encamped at Socho, which is right here on the southern end of the valley, and the Israelites take camp on the opposite side of the valley, on the north side, okay? Now, do this. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 52. Now, I'm not requesting, now I'm telling. 1 Samuel 17, 52. Go there, take a look at that. Now, we know according to the story that David and Goliath meet somewhere on this valley, because again, you got the Israelites to the north, the Philistines to the south, okay? And you have the valley here. David and Goliath meet in this valley. We know that David kills Goliath, right? And according to verse 52, what do the Philistines do? They get scared and they make a run for it, right? And where do they go? They're trying to get to Gath, which is about 4 miles this way to the west. And they're trying to get to Ekron, which is about 8 miles this way to the northwest. The only way that they can flee, they can't flee directly this way. This is all mountains here and hills. It's very steep, rugged terrain. The only way they can get out of here is they got to exit out of the valley this way to the north and then to the west. Does that make sense? It's the only way they can go. They're trying to flee the Israelites who are on this side of the valley. Now, if you notice there in chapter 52 that it talks about how the Israelites slay the Philistines all the way along the road to Gath and to Ekron via the Shaharam Road. Did your Bible say that in verse 52? Shaharam Road? It better, mine does. Okay, some of your Bibles might have a footnote. What does Shaharam mean? Does it say in your Bibles? If it doesn't, I'll tell you. It translates City of Two Gates. City of Two Gates. Now, this poses a problem for archaeologists and historians for many, many, many years. Because they look in this area, and they've been conducting all kinds of digs and excavations here in the Valley of Elah and Azekah and the whole surrounding area. And these are all small towns. These are all small cities. You don't see a city with two gates unless it's a large city like Jerusalem or Hazor, whatever the case is. Because when you put a gate on a wall, that represents the weakest point of defense on that city wall. So if you have a small city, you're not going to put two gates on it. So to them, this was puzzling because they're looking around, they're going, there's no city with two gates around here. Well, lo and behold, as they're working on the Valley of Elah, they do notice that there's this probably very small old town or remnants or remains of a very old town. And that's not unique, guys. They're everywhere in Israel. You're like, oh, why don't they dig here? Because they're digging in these 4,700 other spots. I mean, they're everywhere, okay? But they go and they start sniffing around and they start digging. And I know you're going to find it hard to believe. But when they start digging, what do they find? They find a city with two gates. Which does what? Points to the truth of the veracity of the story that's contained within 1 Samuel 17. This is the Valley of Elah. This is where the battle between David and Goliath took place. And what they did was they cut them off along the Shaharam Road here to Gath and to Ekron. Does that make sense? And we were there. It was amazing. Okay. We're running out of time, but I'm doing good. We've just got a couple more things real quick. Okay. Back here, we're going to the northwestern shore of the Dead Sea, a mile inland, to the caves of Qumran. Now, y'all know these, right? Dead Sea Scrolls, 1946 to 1956. Over a period of 10 years, 11 caves were discovered in which the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. 972 manuscripts, of which 225 of them were biblical texts and fragments that showed every book in the Hebrew, and we say Hebrew Bible, that's for us the Old Testament Bible, okay? Every book of the Hebrew Bible minus Esther. Every other book is found there. Okay? So you go through and we look at the various cave systems. It's vast. Some were very difficult to get to. 11 different caves. Among those scrolls found, the Isaiah Scroll. You familiar with the Isaiah Scroll? Hopefully I think you are. 1947, found in cave number 1 by Bedouin shepherds. 24 feet long. 11 inches wide, It is the entire book of Isaiah intact, beginning to end. All of the biblical texts that we have for us in the Dead Sea Scrolls dates anywhere from 250 to 150 BC, making them the earliest / oldest Hebrew manuscripts we have on record. It's the greatest archaeological find of modern history, without a doubt. Most of them written on some type of parchment, but some written on papyrus, some written on copper as well. All of them written in ancient Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Nabataean as well, written in all those languages. So here we visited the actual city. You have the Qumran caves, but you have the city of Qumran that was inhabited by the Essenes. We know about the Essenes, the Jewish religious sect that existed during the time of Jesus, a much smaller religious sect than the Pharisees and Sadducees. But again, they had separated themselves out to the Dead Sea because they believed that the religious order that was controlled by the Pharisees and Sadducees was corrupted, and they were trying to purify things is what they were trying to do. We might say maybe more of a modern-day reformist. So anyways, we take a look at that. And so this is the city of Qumran in the caves behind us where they lived. Quite extensive. In fact, found among the ruins was a scriptorium, evidences of writing utensils, inkwells in which they would have copied these Dead Sea Scrolls and then put them up in these caves for safekeeping. A large dining hall where secular history tells us that when they came together to commune and to eat, they ate in silence and did not speak to one another. Forgot to put in a picture of the mikvahs. Do you remember the mikvahs from last time, the ritual baths? We showed a picture of one at Qumran. Okay, or Chorazin. In turn, a lot of mikvahs there, the ritual baths, some say the precursor to New Testament baptism, but again, the mikvahs there for their ritual washing, which was very important. They're littered everywhere throughout this site, but again, different areas. In fact, there's kind of a picture of one. Those are steps down into a mikvah, so we got kind of a partial picture of that. 2,700 pictures, I'm sorry, I overlooked one. So with that, with Qumran, again, very fascinating when we look at that. And, of course, the importance of the Dead Sea Scrolls and what that means to us when we're talking about the authenticity of scriptures and knowing that what we have for us today is the recorded word. I mean, these manuscripts even predate the Masoretic text, which our Old Testament is based on. So very, very interesting. So these, you can see copies of these scrolls in the Shrine of the Book at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem there. And there is a picture, we got that off the web, my wife didn't take that picture in the museum, but we got it off the web. That is a picture of the Isaiah scroll, 24 feet long, 11 inches wide. That is the book of Isaiah from front to end. And as you know, the book of Isaiah is pretty lengthy. So, last stop, Masada. How are we doing on time? Okay, we're out of time, I'm sorry, we'll get to this really quickly. Okay, we go to Masada. Masada was a palatial fortress that was built by Herod for refuge from his enemies and also as a winter palace. It is on the southern end of the Dead Sea on the west end. It is 450 meters high as a plateau, 650 meters long, 300 meters across. It's 450 meters high, which guess what? Since it's right off the Dead Sea, that almost puts it at sea level. That's how low the Dead Sea is, all right? So, we get to Masada. Those are the personal palaces, the private palaces that Herod built for himself on the very northern slope of Masada. We'll get and look at that some pictures later. There is the snake or the old road, which you can take if you want to the top of Masada. But again, do you think we took that road? No, we didn't. We took the tram up here, of course. That road looked intimidating, and it is straight up. But we get to Masada. Out there, you can see the Dead Sea, parts of the Dead Sea there, and you can see how steep this plateau is here and the work along the sides. Absolutely fascinating. There is a view from the top looking westward towards the Dead Sea. Really gorgeous. Oh, you see that little square right there? We'll talk about that in 1 second. Okay, so we get to storage rooms, palaces. A synagogue was built up there, baths and storing. Again, all those things were built up there as a fortress to keep him safe from enemies or to spend time there in the winter. This is the northern end of his palaces, as you see there, looking down from the top to the bottom. Look how steep that is. So that's when he woke up in the morning. That's the kind of view that Herod had. Again, private quarters are down that way because invading armies have to get down there, okay? Now, Masada is important because when Herod dies, okay, you have the annexation of Judea back to the Roman government. And so when the Roman government takes control of Masada after Herod's death, they put a garrison up at the top of Masada, okay? And we know, and we'll look at that square there. So that square there, and that square there. We'll talk about that in just a second. Now we know that again, okay, so the Romans take over Masada, they put a garrison up there. The Jewish revolt begins in 66 AD, okay, and it lasts for a period of a few years. Their first order of business in the Jewish revolt is under the captain of the Jewish general, Eleazar ben Yadit, takes control of Masada. The rebels take control of Masada. Now, we say, why do you mention Masada? Matthew chapter 24. We all know Matthew chapter 24. Jesus prophesies the destruction of what city? Jerusalem. Now, you remember what he says there in verse 16? If you can, what do? You run to the hills. Remember that? Verse 16, Judea, you run to the hills. Josephus tells us, General Josephus, a Jewish historian, tells us that some people escape Jerusalem and the destruction of Jerusalem, and they make it to Masada. And that community swells up to about 960 people. Okay? So what happens is, they're in good shape. They're up there in Masada. That's a tough place to penetrate. All right? So what happens is, all the rest of the Jewish strongholds throughout the rebellion from 66 to 70 AD all fall, including the city of Jerusalem. The only stronghold left is Masada. So in 73 AD, the Romans take the 10th Legion. It's hard to tell, but in all of those squares, they got an X. They take the 10th Legion, they break them into eight groups. 10th Legion has 8,000 men. They break them up into eight groups, 1,000 into each group. And where they mark those areas is where those legions station, those different groups. They surveyed those areas and located all eight areas from the diggings. Surrounded, completely surrounded, the city of Masada. And what happens after a few months? The Romans build siege works and a ramp. They break into Masada. They find two women and five children hiding in water cisterns. The rest of the community, numbering some 960 souls, are all dead. They're lying dead. Probably most of you know this story, a lot of you do. And then when the Romans talk to the survivors, the two women and the five children, they ask, what happened to the rest of the community? It was decided by the men that it would be better off for them to take the lives of their own wives and children and themselves, better to take their own lives than to fall into the hands of the Roman oppressors. So, in essence, it was a mass suicide conducted by the men and the heads of the family with those people left remaining. And that's why today, when we talk about Masada, or when a Jew talks about Masada, this is truly a cultural icon to them. I mean, the blood of this place, Masada, still pumps through the hearts of Jews. That's why today they are so defensive of their home country and their continual survival as a people. So, I'm sorry I went 5 minutes over, but I got through it pretty quick. So, that's everything. So, I was happy I was able to do it. We got through Masada. Yeah, we did go to Petra, cue the Indiana Jones music. And we did go to the Wadi Rum, and that's our group. That's in Jordan. And that's the Wadi Rum, and that's where they shot most of Lawrence of Arabia. So it's absolutely gorgeous. That's a Motley Crue if I ever saw one right there. So that's our presentation. Thank you so much for your patience. I know I had to rush through a lot of it. I apologize. If you have questions, please, or I didn't make something clear, come up. Don't hesitate to ask me. I'll try to answer them as best I can. All right? So with that, we certainly never want to close the meeting of God's people without extending the invitation to know that what we have seen here, what we have witnessed through these pictures this evening, one thing that I want to bring forward is that what we have contained in the scriptures is veracity. It is the truth. It is God's word. It is inerrant. It is without error. And what it contains are the commands and the directions for you to be saved and become a child of God. So if you're subject to the gospel call, or if you need spiritual assistance in any manner, we ask that you come forth this time as together we stand and sing this song.